as I was doing this, I reflected on the fact that if there's a particular musician whose work you love, you have a strong sense of that person's character. For me, and I said a minute ago that the Lunsford thing was the starting point, and I backed up and said, no, I had done one other thing first, because I did, in fact, write a different kind of suite of poems out of my engagement with the saxophonist Lester Young, who is a saxophonist I love enormously, and who has huge depth of character.
What a spirit.
Yeah, in his music, and as it comes through in his music. As we know, as a man, actually, in his life, Lester had a lot of problems. Well, okay, who doesn't? And if you'd been Lester Young, so would you, and so would I. You know, his situation was not an easy one in a lot of ways. But when you listen to him play, a great many things are imparted to you. One is just beauty. He's such a beautiful player. But beyond that, you have a sense of a very incisive character. You know, there's somebody there. And when you hear him play, you always know it's him, and you feel that you're in his hands. And that's part of what you want when you go to Lester Young. You know, you want to be in the presence of that character. Now, where does that sense of character come from? It does not come from information, because instrumental music cannot convey information, at least not in the way we usually think of the word information. The sense of character that we have of a confessional poet, quote-unquote, you know, somebody like Robert Lowell, let's say, comes in large part out of the stuff he tells us about, quote-unquote, his life. Although a lot of that stuff is actually made up. The overriding perception that people have of Lowell is that all the stuff in his poetry is actually true and it all happened to him just that way. And the poetry is engineered to make you think that.
Yes.
You know, it's not your fault if you think that. Though if you think about it twice, you will realize that there's more there than meets the eye.
Almost like the appearance of honesty.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of art. It's interesting that, as a matter of fact, that personal information in poetry came to be transgressive. You know, that I can say these personal things in a poem, even though many of them are not very shocking in and of themselves. Some of them are, but many of them are not. It's just shocking that kind of information is in a poem at that time. It's not shocking anymore, by the way. It's been done so much now that you can't shock people by telling them, you know, what's in your laundry basket in a poem. No. But there was a time when you could. Well, my point here is that poetry has become, I think, from say, that time to the present, increasingly information-based. Either personal information-based like that, or information based in the way that a practitioner like, let's say, Albert Goldbarth handles information, or Norman Duby, for that matter. I mean, his poetry is full of information, which is delightful. You know, you learn stuff about, you know, reading a lot of Duby is like reading the encyclopedia, because he reads the encyclopedia a lot,
right.
I think, you know, so it comes out.
Well, I think he does that, and he perhaps gains his information through opening the doors of imagination so that he comes up with things that you feel absolutely must be true of Elizabethan England, but in fact, when you go try and find out about them, you can't find them anywhere in any
way. Yeah, well, which again is the appearance of information. It's false facts, you know, but it is the form of factuality that gives that kind of thing its power, you know.
Yeah.
Music cannot trade in that. There is no way that instrumental music can trade in that kind of information. So if I read Robert Lowell, and I have at least the illusion that I'm learning a lot about Robert Lowell's life, that's one kind of thing. If I listen to Lester Young and I feel somehow or other that I'm learning stuff about Lester Young, how am I learning it? Where is it coming from? I don't know. That is a very mysterious thing. But I also know that if you play in a band full of people, the same people, for a while, even though you may or may not have very substantive conversations with those people, you may, I mean, it just all depends, but I've known a lot of musicians who are not especially articulate people in terms of talking. Some aren't, just like anybody else. But if you spend time in a practice room or on a stage with those same people playing music, you begin to know things about them. You learn things about them. It's
almost like a marriage.
Yeah, it is like that, and it's a kind of quote unquote telepathy, because you don't really know how you learn them. But you do, in fact, learn certain things about them. I mean, if there are certain other kinds of things that you can't learn that way about folks, but you do, in fact, begin to know things about them. And you either know that you love them more than you ever thought you would, because this person seemed this way, but then you discover through what they play on their instrument that they're not that way, they're different. Or you discover that you really don't like them very much.
or they're unreliable.
Or that they're unreliable. Well, that's often the case. And sometimes you even love the unreliable ones, but that's another, again, it's like a marriage. But yeah, you learn these things somehow through what comes out of the instrument. And you can say on the one hand it has to do with your understanding of that person's attention to craft. I admire this musician because he plays so very well, and he therefore must have spent an incredibly disciplined, incredibly lot of disciplined time with that instrument to be able to do that. And that's one kind of respect. Or you can learn something about the quality of their imagination. You can say that you learn something about the quality of their imagination by virtue of the unexpectedness of the things that they play, and yet they're fitting into the context. But that's not all. There's something beneath it that goes way beyond that, and I don't think that we can put into words what it is.
I was thinking about that the other day, though, that when we were getting ready to talk about this, that when you play music with other people, there is a place where you are contributing what you have and they're contributing what they have available. When those two things come together, it's not just that you're involved in the mysteries of synchronicity and harmony, but that actually one of the things that's revealed about the character of that person is the way they approach that challenge, mm-hmm. to work with someone else or to work with the challenge of a new song. And that's terribly revealing about what they're like and what they're going to be. And you almost feel like you do have a secret knowledge about that person that maybe even their intimates, other kinds of intimates, don't know about them.
I think that's right. And furthermore, you realize that when you play in a band like that, if you're learning that kind of stuff about them, they're learning that kind of stuff about you. And it's something that's also unsettling when you begin to think about it that way. You're giving things away about yourself that you don't even know that you're giving away. And they're taking it in. You know, the audience also, of course, gets some of this. But it's different for the audience. And that's one of the things I was thinking about, actually, as I approached the Lunsford band, because those bands were so much about audience. You know, they were so much about context of the dance hall, because that's really where these bands lived. I mean, they of course went into the recording studio from time to time, but that was not their natural habitat. It was a special occasion when they went into a recording studio. Otherwise, they were just on the road in a bus all the time, living terrible lives. And yet, then they would come into the dance hall, what we know, of course, is the recording studio. We assume it probably what went down in the dance hall was even more fun, you know, than what they actually got on tape, because the audience was there, and the interaction with the audience was there, and you know, the excitement was there.
They were part of making the music.
Exactly right. Well, then you begin to think about, well, how did this dynamic work for them within that context and within that setting? And I also began to think, what were they doing as musicians? They were playing popular tunes. Lunsford's band was not really a band that generated new material. They played cover tunes for the most part, though Lunsford was a genius arranger. And this is what those bands like that were really known for, was not so much what kind of new stuff do you do, but how do you arrange that old tune? You know, here this is a Fletcher Henderson arrangement, and it's very different from a Chick Webb arrangement, and it's very different from a Lunsford arrangement, and so on. And this is partly the level on which those bands competed with each other. Who had the best arranger? You know, who did the coolest arrangement of that tune, or the most kind of radical arrangement of it that still would work for a dance audience? You know, it had to work on that level.
That's something that Lunsford's band was known for.
Oh yes, I mean he was a giant arranger. He was a genius. You know, he was great at it, and yeah, he was a sax player too. But a good one. You know, he was a very serviceable alto sax player. But mainly he was an arranger, and also he was the daddy of this band. I mean, he too, not in the same way that Sun Ra was, but all people who run bands like that, especially at that time when, you know, the musicians are, you got that many musicians on a bus going around from city to city, drinking and doing drugs and eating bad food and screwing around and all the rest of it. You know, you have to stay on top of it. And Lunsford was a monster disciplinarian too. I mean, he was tough. He wouldn't let people get away with anything. I don't think he made people sit in closets, as far as I know. Anyway. What's the experience like? What does the musician do in that kind of a band when he or she stands up now to play his ride? It was never he or she in that band. It was always he. They were all men. It's kind of like ships. They would never think about taking a woman on the road with them, I don't think. I don't think Lunsford's band ever had even a woman singer. Well, as that epigraph tells you, the musicians had to do all the singing because he wouldn't put out money to hire dancers or singers. The musicians had to learn to do it. So, okay, now it's my turn to stand up and play. What do I do? Well, in the first place, I have to honor the fact that I'm in the context of a dance hall. So I got to play something that people who are dancing are happy about hearing, which means that it has to work with, you know, the whole rhythm of the dance. So I have to know about that. Even though I might not be a good dancer, I have to understand, you know, how that works. Also, I have to honor the tune, because this is not a situation in which I can stand up and really mess with the tune. You know, the way jazz later started to do, really overtly kind of become dissonant or atonal or arrhythmic or anything like that. You know, and these musicians, you know, of course that music hadn't been invented yet. It was not in their heads. So I got to play something that honors the tune in some way. At the same time, I have to make a statement that's personal in a sense. That is to say, I have to play what I play now in such a way that my style as a saxophonist or as a trumpet player or whatever it might be is distinct. I mean, so that the dancers will recognize me. Because that was very important in those bands, too. They all had stars in them, you know. When Lester Young was in a band, he was always the star. People always loved him, even though the musicians might not, as a matter of fact. When he played with Fletcher Henderson's band, they hated the way he played because he didn't sound like Coleman Hawkins, who had been immediately before the tenor saxophonist. And they tried to make him play like Coleman Hawkins, and he wouldn't do it. And he was just this young cat. You know, he wasn't yet, you know, Coleman Hawkins was the star of the tenor sax. He was the only one, really. And so they all said, you got to sound like Hawk, man. You can't sound like that. And he said, I'm Lester Young. I sound like this. And the people hearing it loved it. And Fletcher Henderson actually thought, this guy's got something. But the musicians so disliked him that they drummed him out of the band. They basically fired him because he didn't sound like Coleman Hawkins.
I'm glad to hear that because I've been kicked out of some bands, too.
Well, there are all kinds of reasons for being kicked out of bands, and not to say that you were kicked out for reasons other than being you. But, you know, the fact is that, therefore, you know, you stand forward so that you play the distinct thing so that the people in the audience would go, oh, yeah, I like this band because it's got him in it, and he plays that way. And then underneath that, too, of course, you have your personal pride. And you play not only for the dancers, but you play for the other people in the band. You know, now here's where things really start to get interesting, because you play on a bunch of different levels if you're playing that music in that context. You play the thing that pleases the dancers, but you also play the thing that is cool, whatever that might mean in that particular context, so that all the musicians go, yeah, you know, that what he just did there, the dancers never even notice it, but that was really cool. You know, I get it.
Did you find yourself, when you were creating the suite for Jimmy Lunsford, did you find yourself taking some of the imagery out of the road life of those musicians? Did you feel like that was coming in? Or was it like inhabiting some part of your psyche and your experience and that kind of thing? Because I know you've had some road experience yourself.
Yeah, but I did, in fact, do the thing you're talking about. Partly road experience idea, but also partly... I mean, another thing that I didn't say just now when I talked about what that musician does when he stands forth and plays, another thing that gets reflected in the music, though this is probably never conscious, is that something about the social and historical moment in which you were living is reflected in what you play. Because it's in the song, because it's in the dancers and the dance, because it's in the musicians, it's in the whole context. And as I was listening to Lunsford's band, I was thinking, I'm learning some things here about the 30s and 40s. You know, I'm not quite sure I know what they are, but I know that I'm absorbing something of that milieu, and I tried to give that back in the poems that I wrote too. Now, of course, it's all sort of made up out of the very unreliable substance of stuff that I already know about that time period and things that I imagine about it. You know, so that in terms of quote unquote truth, forget it. But in terms of what I was up to, I wanted to have that flavor, the way music has the flavor of its moment. Good music, of course, has more than that. Good music becomes, in some sense, quote-unquote, timeless, you know. But it also, and I think this is part of its timelessness, it is bound to its historical moment, and it reflects it. So I'm thinking, well, if one should write a history of America in the 20th century based only on jazz, and not about the history of jazz, but only on the music itself and what you learn about that time and that place through what you hear, what would that look like? And that was part of what I was trying to convey in these poems, too. The little narratives that are in a lot of the poems, as you say, there's no overarching narrative, but many of the poems have narratives embedded in them. And those things are all little fictions spun out of this idea. Because it does seem to me that if you had a history of America based on what you got out of jazz, it wouldn't involve presidents and armies. You know, it wouldn't involve wars and stuff like that. It wouldn't involve elections. What it would involve is the joys and the pains of very ordinary people's lives.
Well, it feels very much like for anyone who's seen the movie Wings of Desire, you know, you're like one of those Rilkean angels that come and tap into the stream that's flowing off the people of that time, what the emotions and the images and the background experiences and the fears that they have. And what's fascinating about that for me, reading your work, is that that becomes a vehicle for meditation about things that those people themselves might not have ever articulated in the way that you are in your poems. I mean, you're approaching certain philosophical and religious concepts that were theirs in a sense. I mean, in a manner of speaking, they certainly were things those people were facing, but they would never have been able to articulate them.
Or rarely. Some of them might have some of the time, but
or they would do it in music or something.
Well, and there it is. I mean, that's music, I think, is in fact precisely, at least partly, the articulation of that kind of thing. It's part of the genius of the great practitioner that he or she can do that. It's an act of translation, in fact, on the one hand. I mean, that is to say, one translates everything about one's life through one's instrument in the moment of standing up to take a ride in a band. You know, it's different when you're sitting down in the section, because then you're not really articulating anything other than what the composer and arranger want you to articulate. But when you stand up to ride, that's different. Now, you know, the thing expands, and it expands in the hands of that particular practitioner. And this is what we appreciate often, I think, in the work of the best of these musicians, is how they did that. Lester Young, certainly. I mean, in him you hear ecstasy and despair all at once.
One of the questions that I know you and I have both been asked is, how does being a musician affect your being a poet? Is there something you get out of it? And one of the things I've thought about in relation to that, and during the course of this conversation I've thought about, your primary chosen field of music is jazz and blues. Mm-hmm. And I've done a lot of bluegrass, which many people might not realize is almost exactly the same thing. Mm. Especially Bluegrass Breakdown, that book points out that just as with jazz music, in bluegrass music, the roots that change the way that particular soloing is done are very African. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting thing too. For both you and I, we have come into contact with very powerful African-American voices in this music, and that has changed the person that I am. I mean, mm-hmm. Coltrane has changed who I am. You know,
yeah. Furthermore, I postulate, and I realized this some years ago when I began to research the music and the poetry of the 1920s at one point, for various reasons. And when I started kind of resurrecting for myself a lot of the white music of that time, I realized some interesting things. In fact, one of the sections of this book is Suite for Adrian Rollini, and it's in fact the first section in the book, and it's going to puzzle people because nobody will know who the hell I'm talking about, which is by design, by the way, because all the musicians I chose for this are relatively obscure now. I mean, Lunsford is not exactly a household word now. Big Maybell, I mean, nobody knows who that is, except R&B musicians know, but you know, she was a jump blues singer. She's one of the ones who gets focused on. Sun Ra is more visible, I suppose, in a way, though I find that people know about him as a character, but not really his music. They don't really know his music very well, most people. Right. And then, you know, the one exception is Lester Young, though I've sort of backed away from making him be the focal character in that poem for various reasons, but that's a different topic. But Rollini, all these musicians are African-American musicians, except Rollini. Rollini was a white player. Furthermore, he was the greatest ever practitioner of the bass saxophone. Hmm. And one of the reasons why he's the greatest ever is because about mid-career for Rollini, the bass saxophone just disappeared from sight. And in fact, Rollini himself turned into, for about the last half of his career, a rather mediocre vibes player. He was this great bass saxophone player, and then the culture just fell away from that. Nobody wanted a bass sax. And so he had to fall back on his knowledge of keyboard, which is what he started off on. In any case, Rollini, of this group, is the only white musician. And the kind of music he played is interesting to listen to now because it seems so, at first sight, it seems rather square, as we would say. He played mostly with Bix Beiderbecke.
Oh, yeah.
And that music, it sounds a little funny to us now. You know, it's that's sort of quote-unquote white jazz, especially when it becomes the music of somebody like Paul Whiteman, which is utterly awful, as far as I'm concerned. Whiteman sort of, he tried to make an orchestra out of a jazz band. He had huge bands and these really elaborate arrangements. And Beiderbecke was often playing with him. And so was the C melody sax player Frankie Trumbauer, who was one of the greatest practitioners also of the saxophone of that time. But he's relatively unknown, partly because his instrument too disappeared, the C melody saxophone. Nobody plays that anymore. He was a primary influence on Lester Young. And one of the reasons why Lester sounds the way he does is because he was, as a young man, emulating a saxophone voice that was higher than the tenor. Because the C melody saxophone is in between the tenor and the alto. And Lester gets this kind of floaty light sound that's very much like Frank Trumbauer. But Adrian Rollini also was in that sphere. He did, in fact, front bands of his own. He was highly respected by all of his peers. And he's just gone, man. You know, so, but listening to that music is interesting because there's a quality about it that we don't associate with jazz anymore, rhythmic quality. It's that kind of rickety-tick music that it makes people think of those black and white Disney cartoons with little mice dancing and like that kind of thing. You know,
yes.
Rickety-tickety, chickety, chickety. You know, it's rhythmically, it's not what jazz later became. Nor is it like what, let's say, Armstrong was doing rhythmically. And one of the reasons I think that kind of music is what it is because it was being played largely for white audiences, for them to dance to, and they danced a certain way. And furthermore, the rhythm that was being conveyed through bands like Whiteman's band and through Rollini's bands and Beiderbecke too, was the rhythm of their lives. African American musicians were projecting different kinds of rhythms, and that rhythm later became more and more mainstream. And I postulate that music has not only changed the way we think about music, so that it's hard for us to go back to that old music and listen to it straight. And really give it its due, because it's actually wonderful music. I mean, Beiderbecke is a wonderful player. Trumbauer is a wonderful player. Rollini is wonderful. But it's hard to listen to that music now without laughing. You know, your first reaction is to laugh. There's another musician that I researched and found fascinating once I got into him, who is almost completely unknown now. Though in the day, he was a superstar. He was the first saxophone superstar. And I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name. It's a German name. Rudi Widerft, I suppose you say. Wideft, if you were an American, you know. I don't know how he pronounced it, whether he gave it a German pronunciation. But he was a vaudeville musician, and he didn't play anything remotely resembling jazz. It was kind of like light classic, or it was novelty tunes. And he was a monster technician. You listen to him now, and once you get past the stupidness of the music and the squareness of it, you know, you think, Jesus Christ, this guy could play. Man, he was just a monster. But nobody knows about him now because that music sounds so ricky ticky 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 tick. It's the rhythm. It's the rhythm. And you know, the rhythms that came basically out of Africa and out of the Caribbean and out of Latin America too were so much more interesting and so much more compelling and so much more passionate and so much more overwhelming. That pretty soon, you know, that rickety-tick music was gone. I began to reflect on the fact that the jazz age, so-called, was named after that music. Anyway, it, you know, just as a sidebar on this whole thing, it occurred to me that when they talk about the writing of the so-called jazz age, it's about that music. Elliot, I dare say, never went down to a bar and heard a black band playing. He was exposed some to vaudeville, I know that, and he was exposed to dance hall, white dance hall music. And so, likewise, Fitzgerald and all those white writers who, the jazz age, they were hip. You know, no, the jazz age, they were listening to, you know, they were listening to Adrian Rollini. They were listening to Beiderbecke, if they were lucky. They were listening to worse bands. You know, they were listening to, but that's what they mean when they don't mean the kind of jazz we think about now.
Although the Wasteland was vastly improved by his being able to go and taste some other voices, and he do the Police in different voices was the original title.
Yes.
So
he's
picking some streams up.
Yes, he is. I mean, it's more complicated than I'm making it out, but it was a revelation to me to think, well, this is really what most folks meant by jazz at the time.
Yes.
It was, you know, it wasn't Oliver and Armstrong. It wasn't stuff like Basie, which came later, really. It was this stuff, you know. But my point is then that along comes this other thing, which is so much more potent. Of course, it starts off in the dance halls. It works its way onto the airwaves and you know, through recordings. And I postulate that it changed not only the way we think about music, but the way we think about dancing, of course, but also the way we walk and talk. The rhythms of our speech, the rhythms of our movements are different, no matter how we think about ourselves. The fact is, we are all products of a Creole society. And that's good. I mean, that's a strength because, of course, African-American music would not be what it is without the American part. That is to say, without what came in from Europe through that particular threshold. You know, that's part of it, too. You would not have jazz had you not had French marching bands, as well as the blues, you know, those things that come all together. And gospel music would not be what it is without, on the one hand, the African rhythm colliding with, you know, the old Anglo hymn. You know, it's just all part of a, it becomes part of a national fabric. And there's a lot of argument, of course, about race in the history of music, and it's a healthy argument as long as it's approached reasonably, you know. But as soon as somebody says they own this music and it doesn't belong to anybody else, I think they're wrong.
Well, that's one of the great ironies of bluegrass music, is that it actually has two roots, just like jazz does, and one of them's European, Uncle Penn's Scottish and Irish fiddle tunes, and then Arnold Schultz's unlikely name for a black man, but a blues guitarist who Bill Monroe was devoted to, and who taught Bill Monroe much of what he came to think of as the essential element that put the drive into bluegrass music, and of course also encouraged that whole nature of outrageous soloing that goes on, although it's tempered in bluegrass in a way that maybe it's not in jazz music.
Yeah, well, but it is. I mean, it depends on what jazz you're talking about, because there is, I think that bluegrass music oddly resembles bebop that way. Mm-hmm. You know, because what you have in bebop is blues sped up. The bebop musicians were mostly not geniuses at composing new tunes, though they did compose lots of new tunes, but mostly you immediately recognize them as reworkings of older tunes. And what they did with them was they often made the harmonic structures a little more complicated than they had been, and different in certain ways, but they sped them up. So, you know, Charlie Parker on the alto saxophone is not that different from Earl Scruggs on the banjo. You know, it's just a sped up thing. It's like sped up blues, with a different kind of rhythmic drive. Certainly, too. That's another thing. I mean, the rhythms of bebop are different from the rhythms of blues, just as the rhythms of bluegrass are different from the rhythms of blues or gospel.
Right.
No doubt about it. But yeah, it's a lot about speed at that point. And not all jazz is that way. You know, there was a reaction against that in the modal music of Miles Davis and later of Coltrane. They didn't want so many fast chord changes and so much fast running. There's plenty of speed in those musicians. Well, in Coltrane, not so much in Davis. He got more and more minimal as he went, as a reaction against that kind of music. I'm not sure that reaction is set into bluegrass.
He was a ceaseless changer and inventor.
Well, I have a feeling that he did in fact cease once he got into that kind of bad fusion phase.
He was trying to make money.
Well, yeah, he had money. I don't know. I don't really understand. He was trying to just piss people off sometimes. But that's okay. I mean, that's part of what it's about,
well,
too.
Well, that certainly was part of his nature.
That's part of what it's about, too. I mean, that is to say, there's always an uneasy relationship between the individual's creative drive and traditions in jazz music, just as there is in bluegrass music. I mean, that's one difference, I think, between jazz and bluegrass is that the traditions that drive bluegrass music per se are tighter than those that drive jazz.
Well, the thing that frustrates me with bluegrass music is that very thing. And in fact, I don't just live there. I'm interested in the musicians in bluegrass who are themselves, when you listen to them, they come very close to being jazz musicians. And in fact, I've heard some sessions with players like Tim O'Brien and Bela Fleck and Sam Bush.
Keep coming back to this notion of form and its power on the one hand and its limitations on the other. I mean, that's what form does, is it sort of empowers by limiting, but it also can stifle by limiting, and that's always the struggle, I think, in any art. This is one of the commonalities between poetry and practice of whatever kind of music you're talking about, I think, is that the individual practitioner is positioned in the middle of so many different vectors of force. The history of the art, whether it be music or poetry, the history of the culture that embraces or doesn't embrace that art, the history of the culture that embraces or doesn't embrace that individual. The story of the art of African American musicians like Lester Young is in part that story. You can't do Lester's biography and not notice that he's an African American, and then he suffered certain things on account of that. You just can't, you couldn't do the biography without doing that. You know, you just couldn't, any more than you could do a biography of somebody like Bix Beiderbecke and not notice that that he was an oddly obscure white musician who had, within the realm of white audiences, almost no following. He was not like a superstar, that guy, partly because there was not yet an audience in white America, a very big one, equipped to make somebody like him into a superstar. I mean, in another context, he had all the equipment as a musician.
Great, you know, player. Yeah.
To be a superstar. But he was not known in his time, or very little known by, to anybody other than musicians, you know, the ones who knew him all respected him, but he was not known, and his name was not a draw. You know, you wouldn't see him upon a marquee, Big Spiderbeck playing tonight. No, I mean, it would always be whatever orchestra he was with.
Well, it took such a long time, and of course this process is not yet complete, mm-hmm. for white America to be able to not foreground the matter of race in mm-hmm. understanding anyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like with John Coltrane, it certainly is not in any way possible to ignore that he was African American and that had all that history. But of all the things that you want to pay attention to about him, that's not the most important thing.
I agree. And things were different by the time he came along. I mean, partly because, I mean, the cultural context was changing, but the artistic context was changing too, because by the time Coltrane was there doing what he did, jazz was art. And for a player like Beiderbecke, jazz was not art. It wasn't even jazz, but it wasn't art. It was dance music, you know. And so, from that point of view, if you found yourself somebody who was married to a trumpet, then you were also married to that world, and you didn't have a whole lot of choice about it. And he lived a kind of miserable life and died a hideous death,
way
too young.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think partly had to do with what might want. I don't know how it felt to him. Who the hell knows? But I mean, I don't think it's romantic to say that in a certain sense he died of a broken heart by virtue of being a great artist who really had almost nobody there to appreciate him except the other artists.
It's funny that I, on the one hand, I feel like I really envy him the experiences he had, you know, playing hooky from high school and then going off and joining both. He played in Chicago for a while and then later in New York, right? Mm-hmm. And in both places, being able to sit in on sessions with some of the most amazing players on earth, I know that in and of itself must have been absolutely spectacular and marvelous. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the world had no place for him.
Right. The world had no place. Well, the musical world had a little place for him, but the world of listeners, the only place for Beiderbecke was an anonymous trumpet player in a section in a dance hall who once in a while got to step forward and do something cool, you know. And people would go, oh, that was cool, but I'm dancing, you know. And there's nothing wrong with that, by the way, in just in those terms. But for him, the problem becomes, well, as compared, let's say, to an equivalent African-American musician of that time, in the dance hall, people really were heroes in that context. In a way, I think in the white world, they weren't quite yet, you know. That is to say, the African-American community embraced that music right away because it was theirs, you know. It was right away theirs. It was for white audiences, it had to be translated into other terms at first, and that's why the rhythm's different, say, you know. It has to have a different kind of feel, partly because it would have been for many listeners who didn't have the context for it, it would have been just weird. And also it would have been, for many listeners who didn't have the context for it, alas, scary. And
yes.
So it had to be toned down and whitened up.
Yep.
And black musicians suffered terribly in that society. But in another way, so did many white musicians for different reasons and different kinds of suffering. But nevertheless, you know, there it was. There were artists who knew there was something out there that in another place and time they could really be part of. But the world would not let the black musicians and the white musicians really be together.
Well, that's brings us to maybe a kind of parallel between jazz music and poetry today. Both of them art forms which attract large numbers of people to them, both as practitioners and enjoyers, and yet the culture at large insists on calling them both marginal arts.
Mm-hmm. That's quite true. And I think there's a real
similarity. Probably because they don't communicate enough.
That's probably true.